out there, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tim Benal. Welcome to this week's edition of Benal of America Audio Season 1. We continue this week with Peter Robbins, Part 2 of 2. An amazing conversation. I was listening to it earlier today while I was getting it ready, and I really just stopped doing everything and ended up just listening and enjoying the interview. So I think everyone's really going to like this second half of the interview as much as they like the first half. I've gotten a lot of great feedback for it, so thanks a lot for that. A little bit about Peter Robbins, if you're jumping in here at part 2 of 2 and haven't jumped back yet for part 1 of 2. Peter Robbins has been involved in UFO studies for more than 25 years as a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, activist, and author. He is a board member of the Bud Hopkins Intruders Foundation and is co-author of the British bestseller Left at Eastgate, a first-hand account of the Bentwaters-Woodbridge UFO incident, its cover-up, and investigation. Peter is a current contributor to Phenomena Magazine, UFO Magazine, UFO Report Japan, Fate Magazine, PhenomenaMagazine.com, and UFOData.uk, amongst many other publications and websites. He's also served as art director and investigator for the New York City-based Scientific Bureau of Investigation, a national police and civilian UFO research organization, and as editorial assistant on Blue Memorandum, for Parliament's House of Lords debate on UFOs in January of 1980. He was also the research assistant on United Nations Secretary General's report for the establishment of a UN UFO department. He's a native New Yorker, and he's this week's guest on Benal of America Audio. We continue the conversation we had last week. We pick it up here with about another hour of talk on Left at Eastgate, not only the Rendlesham Forest incident, but also what happened throughout the process of creating the book, and ultimately the post-book reaction from ufology and the UK and the world at large. Peter also lets us know about the updated and expanded edition of Left at Eastgate that's scheduled for publication by Cosimo Press sometime this December. We'll have the information out to the BenalofAmerica.com visitors as soon as we get it from Peter, so hopefully people can grab this book. I know I'll be picking up a copy of this updated and expanded edition because I'm really interested in what's going to be in there. This interview was recorded on September 5th, 2005, Labor Day. Peter Robbins, Part 2 of 2 on Benal of America Audio, Season 1.
You take this first trip to England. That's a pretty big part of the story, too.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that stuck out to me was you're riding in the cab, and the cab driver, he's pretty skeptical, and he's, he kind of shits on you guys, or shits on the story.
Sure.
Like, they were out in the woods smoking pot. And
yeah, oh, sure.
You're there with Larry, and that had to happen more often than just that one time in situations like that. What was Larry's reaction when someone, because he was, you know, he experienced it. What was he like when someone was like, those guys are full of shit?
It was interesting. He was at his best at those moments. It wasn't like, oh, yeah, you know, you're wrong, you're a lie, you know,
yeah.
I was there. He actually impressed me very much. He's a very people-oriented person, and he's great at chatting people up. And I've heard him, you know, more than once say, well, you know, let me tell you, I was there. It really happened. And let me give you some particulars. I think he, you know, he's a smart guy. He's pretty worldly. He understands that that's human nature. It was, you know, the media and the forces that be worked very hard, as they always have, to make this a laughable subject.
Yeah.
You know, ha-ha, flying saucers, little green men, that kind of thing. But, you know, in just the opposite way, when we first went on base that first night and he chatted up that security cop who essentially was him, you know, 8 years before,
mm-hmm.
and says without any prompting, you know, my friend and I are working on a book about some stuff that happened to me in the service here. He's never been in the service, so he doesn't know. You and I know. You know, when you get to a new base, it's legends, myths, stories, and it's the first thing the new guys are told by the old guys. What do you know here? And the kid got very serious and said, there's only one story here, and that's, I don't know how you feel about it. Got a little defensive, but UFO situation, it was real. You know, it was hushed up. It was very serious. Guys were sent all over the place, and some bad things happened, and, you know, we take it very seriously. And it was the first time ever, after 8 or 9 months hearing this kid say that, that I had heard anybody back up the story completely independently on their own without any prompting. And it was the first of many, many, many guys that I met that backed up the story in earnest. And as you also know, the most dramatic part of that first visit over was, much to my horror, although a lot of people think, oh, how cool, you had an experience too, we had our own multiple UFO incident there.
Yes.
And that blew my mind. I had so prized being the objective chronicler, and all of a sudden I am in deep shit. I am part of the story. That did not make me happy. And we audio taped those things while they were happening to us. And those tapes, I should say, have been voice stress analyzed. And there is no, you know, acting going on. We saw an extraordinary variety of things that night, culminating with a thing appearing in the field that we were in. And I was very anxious. I was frightened. And Larry was angry. And as far as the things kind of coming back, and at the same time, he was extremely reflective and almost philosophical, like, they're here. I told you they were here. And you had to see it for yourself. The first night, I mean, I agonized. I agonized over whether or not to even include it. And we had like an hour and a half on tape where we're freaking out. And it was still going on when we left.
Yeah.
I mean, we got to England the day before. We still had jet lag. It was our first trip of our first research trip of many, first night. And I was even had a moment where I thought to myself, maybe if I say it happened on the third night, and then I caught myself in a second. I said, you know, you're writing nonfiction here.
Yeah.
You lie once, you're a liar, and that's it.
Yeah.
And you can't just say, oh, yeah, and by the way, on the first night, we saw 30 UFOs, and then jump. You've either got to deal with this in-depth or not. And ultimately, after basically weighing it for months, and Larry said, it's, you know, your call, I decided to go with it. I spent months transcribing it. I listened to certain parts of that tape 50 times easy to make sure I had every syllable right, because I knew somebody's going to call me on it.
Yeah.
And so that transcript is, it's very, very, it captures what happened to us in the field that night in no uncertain terms. I was not happy about that at all. I'm there with, again, the most controversial witness. We're 5 miles, 6 miles from the site of the original incident. And what do you know? Our first night, I see 30 UFOs. Oh, boy. What a coincidence. Gee whiz. I mean, I'd call me a liar. But I wasn't lying. It happened.
Now, were your fears that that would affect the story justified? Did that hurt? Do you think, you know, you were all upset that it happened, but did that sort of come to fruition?
You know, that's interesting. Not really. I made it very clear in the research community that if anybody wanted to call us on that, I would loan them, if it was, you know, a responsible situation, I would loan somebody with the credentials to do VSA, voice stress analysis work, original tapes, to verify the genuine stress in the voices and the reality of the situation. And ultimately, several years after the book came out, we were called on that by two guys that did VSA. And they ran them and said, yeah, you know, best we can say, this is the truth, as you guys were experiencing it or thought you were experiencing it. And even, you know, the late Phil Klass, the king of debunkers, never brought this up. I never saw in the literature even the few bad reviews that we got. Our reviews overwhelmingly were terrific for the book, very flattering. Nobody called us on that. It's, maybe the thought was, that's just too ridiculous to lie about. And although I was not a terribly well-known person in the field, I'm proud to say nobody has ever called me a liar. Nobody has ever accused me of fabricating or enhancing or spinning information. Not ever. And it's something I pride myself on, and I don't. So I think a little bit of my reputation helped there. But it happened. It was real. And there's no question about it.
The scariest part of the thing I wanted to mention was the scream.
And you can, I'm going to tell you, Tim, that I, even just hearing you say that, the hair's going up on my arms. And on those first generation audio tapes, and we're saying on the tapes, gee, I bet you can't hear that. You can hear it. you can hear the screams coming from the woods. And it's like not quite a human sound. It's I won't even try to imitate it. But
it freaked me out just reading it. Oh, it was awful. Although I did enjoy the Woody Allen joke. I got a real kick out of that.
Well, nervous humor
is
such interesting stuff, and you do bring up an interesting point, 'cause in stress, you know, some of us, depending on our personalities, we will, you know, kind of lean back on black humor. It's all we have.
Yep.
And a year or so after that, I had taken a summer teaching post in rural Oklahoma, and I was put up with a local family, and I liked them a lot. The man was a retired petroleum engineer, Phillips Petroleum, and he was, you know, like engineers, he was all facts, and he found my story interesting, but I could see his eyebrows sort of rhetorically moving up. And there is a sound in these tape recordings that I think I even list in the transcriptions. It is the click of my Zippo lighter. We're smoking our way through this thing like banshees. And he said, you know, I have a problem with that. I said, what do you mean, Bill? He said, well, you know, you're smoking while this is going on. I said, and? He said, well, you're taking the time to smoke cigarettes. That's not my picture of somebody in stress. I said, Bill, are you a smoker? I said, have you ever smoked? He said, no. I said, talk to your friends who are smokers. It is a way of relieving stress, and often in high stress is when smokers smoke the most.
Yeah.
And we even joked at that point that we should have gotten a grant from Reynolds Tobacco, because we went through a lot of cigarettes at that point. I just recently quit smoking, and hopefully this will stick this time. But my smoking habit is exacerbated by this tremendously, and Larry is still wrestling with it. But yeah, those screams were absolutely haunting. I'll never forget them.
Now, after this whole thing happened, you guys went there, you checked it out, Larry took you through the whole thing.
Yeah.
Then you came back to the States, and it seemed like the book kind of fell apart there.
Yes, it did.
What happened there?
Well, what happened was I came back with way more than I had thought humanly possible. I was nervous. I was anxious. I was excited, but in a really almost hysterical way. I was beginning to feel I was getting in over my head. And we got back at the end of February. And in April, Larry came to the city, and I recreate this in the book, but essentially what he says to me is, I felt that if I told you everything that I thought or that I knew when I enrolled you in this project, that you would not have signed on and you wouldn't have gone to England and we wouldn't have gotten started on this, so let me complete some things here. When I said a guy I knew, that was me, and I have to tell you, a few weeks before we went to England, I was yet once again, as I've been several times since this happened, approached by and met with representatives of the National Security Agency, who said, in so many words, so we understand you're getting started on your book and you've enrolled this guy Robbins to work with you. We've checked him out. You know, you can do it if you want. Who's going to believe your book anyway? And I was frightened and enraged that the National Security Agency had run a background check on me.
Yeah.
How dare they? And that they cleared me to write a book that, you know, it's okay if you want to write a book with him. I was furious, and I was very frightened. And I also, there was the variable that Larry could be a psychotic liar, and that this hadn't happened or it had happened, and that he hadn't met with the agency, and he made that up. And, well, I was on overload. I was on complete overload. At this point, I also knew about, you know, the fourth night, where he is subdued chemically and taken below the base, and holy Christ, I was freaking.
Yeah.
And I made it very clear to him in very flat language that I had had it, at least for a while, and I backed out. And he said, I understand, and I hope you'll come back to this, but I understand, and I'm sorry for any grief I've caused you. He was hurting, man, and now I was.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't speak to him for months at that point, but, you know, I couldn't walk away from the whole subject. I spent a lot of time at the main branch of the New York Library there doing supporting research, but slightly off topic, came back to it. But by the end of 88, I was infused. I was like, you know, a zealot at that point, and I knew this was the most important story I might be involved in my life. And I was already sort of distancing myself from friends and family, and I'm a pretty social and gregarious guy. I'm usually kind of enjoyable to be around. Good stories.
I think you're a great character. Yeah, you're a nice guy.
Thanks.
I've personally met you, hung out with you. That's true.
But I was changing, and I wasn't such a nice guy, and romantic relationships that I was pursuing fell apart. I was got into this real neurotic dynamic of, you know, kind of like the old Groucho Marx quote of, I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me as a member.
Yeah.
I didn't want any woman to get involved with me that I really cared for, because that would be irresponsible of me. It could really hurt their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
When this was going on, the good case in point, I was dating a wonderful woman who I was quite in love with. She was Irish, here on a green card, and not only worked at the UN, but worked in the office of the Secretary General. She's still with the UN, and that relationship self-destructed, and I became quite unhinged in terms of just sort of losing a lot of my, not losing my good friends, but holding them away in some cases for years. I mean, the good ones stayed with me, but I pushed a lot of people away, and I come from a very close family. My family was concerned about me, and I had sort of lost my career fix at a point, and I was really kind of coming off my moorings a bit. But the one thing that I was stuck on and committed to was seeing this thing through, or at least doing my best to see it through. And ultimately, much to both of our amazements, in a way, we not only finished the book, but we sold the book and got it published and got it out there in two countries. And it changed things in Britain.
And during this time that you were going through all this thing, you allude to, I don't know if it's another book or something, but it's called Confidential.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very good. You know, I don't know if anybody's ever asked me about that. More and more, I was aware, and it's on the record, I'm not speaking out of school here, Larry was not just struggling with what had happened to him. He was drinking a lot and not showing it. He was aggressive. He could be, emotionally abusive. He could threaten, you know, you'd get the feeling that potentially he could be violent. Never was me. His marriage is going to hell. I literally watched it self-destruct, his first marriage. Also, I realized that whether or not, you know, he was everything he seemed to be and was somebody that certain people would rather not have here, or whether or not he just, you know, drank too much one night and crashed his car, or, you know, had some kind of alcohol-related physical crisis, he could die. And I began to more and more feel that if he did, I don't know what would happen to me. I mean, I was feeling emotionally and mentally like I had to have something to confirm that my stress was real and it wasn't from my imagination.
Yeah.
And as you know, it was the only time I ever did this, but several times in 88, I think three times, I tape recorded him on the phone without telling him. And I led him into saying certain things and putting them on the record so that I'd have them in case he vaporized one day and I could at least say, look, I wasn't crazy. You know, I believe this guy and this is what he said and here's the tape. Confidential was my way of trying to preserve my sanity and create a record that if anything should happen to me, that my family would know what I had really gotten into. And what it was, in essence, was totally separate from my work on the manuscript and my research on the aspects of the case. I created an entirely separate book in a loose leaf binder in an edition of one. And then I made two copies of it. I made several copies of these tapes. I put one in my vault in the bank, One I physically hid. One I gave to a very good friend for safekeeping. And emotionally, it was a really good thing for me because it allowed me to have what I laughingly call, in this case, a little peace of mind to move forward and know that at least I was on the record should anything happen to Larry or me. And I still have that copy of Confidential that I kept and those tapes, even with, you know, sort of a note written, I didn't mean to be macabre, but written to be read.
In the event of your demise?
Yes, correct.
Huh.
Yes, correct.
Wow.
And it allowed me to go forward. It also gave me what I needed to later that year in 88, possibly 89, I'd have to check the book for it actually, to say to Larry months after, I have to tell you what I did in 88 and then laid it out for him.
Yeah.
I recorded you on these three times and blah, blah, blah. And I remember him on the phone just being quiet for a moment saying, I absolutely understand and would have done the same thing in your case. And, you know, those conversations are also the best parts of those transcriptions are in Left at Eastgate, and they are, as far as I'm concerned, available to responsible researchers, and they're part of the record of the book. Yeah, that's what Confidential was about.
And so what ultimately got you back into the book? You had fallen out of the whole thing, and then all of a sudden you sort of re-infused to get this project done. What happened?
Well, it wasn't any one thing. It was just I realized that I had gotten in over my head, and I got used to it. I realized that if I was serious about being a good investigative writer, I was never going to find a better story in my life. If I had gone this far, and I thought, okay, we're a year or so into it, so, you know, how much longer can it be, thinking it'd be another year or so, that if I walked away from this, it'd haunt me the rest of my life. I'm not a quitter, although I'm not, you know, stupid and obsessive, and if I get into something that is way beyond me, I would hope I'd have the good sense to back out of it.
Yeah.
In this case, though, I felt if I didn't complete it or give it my best shot, I'd regret it. It would haunt me. It'd be something to not be proud of.
Yeah.
Plus, there's a kind of a fatalistic aspect of, well, what the hell else do I have to do with my life right now? I've kind of screwed up the rest of it. I've lost my teaching position. I've sort of walked away from it and didn't bother to get it back. I've drifted out of my theater work. I'm not painting and drawing right now. I wanted to finish the job that we had started. And by that point, almost begrudgingly, Tim, I had no intention or even desire of this guy being a friend of mine. It was a professional acquaintance and, you know, obviously, somebody who had certain problems, and I was not interested in becoming, you know, a pal, although, you know, we were friendly, of course. But I really grew to admire him. I saw the other side of him, too, when he'd show it, of a really decent, big-hearted guy who had tremendous principles and values and a good heart, and we had things in common in terms of our taste in pop music. And so, ultimately, I got myself back into it. It wasn't any one dramatic thing. It was that desire that people have to finish what they start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so then you're sort of working back on the book again, and then enters one of the most important people in the whole saga, that's Colonel Holt.
Yes.
You all of a sudden, you have his number, you decide to call him. Why then? Had you been waiting a while?
Well, up until I called him, he was still in active service.
Okay.
This had happened to him when he was Lieutenant Colonel, 1980, and it wasn't until 91 or 92, I forget exactly, maybe 93, that he retired. And I had wanted to speak to this guy like crazy. I mean, who better? But frankly, I was a little intimidated. I didn't know how I should reach him. I also was very aware in life that you only have one chance to make a first impression. Mm-hmm. I knew there was no love lost between him and Larry, and that I was now working with Larry, so maybe he saw me as the enemy or something.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I had mentioned to some mutual friend in the field that I really wanted to speak to this guy, and he said, hey, he wants to speak to you too. I said, what? said, yeah, I know for a fact that he knows that you're working on this book with Warren, and he wants to talk to you. It's like, shit. I got his number, and I remember before making that first call of quite a number, I laid out quite a working sort of whole desktop of notes to refer to should he try to, you know, catch me off guard on something.
Yeah.
I was not going to play all my cards of things that I know. He did not know, for example, that I had not just some of Larry's service record, but some of Larry's original service record. Also, I knew through the grapevine that he was bad-mouthing Larry and saying that he was a wannabe, that he might not have been involved at all, that, you know, there were other factors and that he'd been jerked around and, you know. I called him, and he was home in Woodbridge, Virginia, and was very cordial on the phone and immediately tried to get me off guard by saying, I'm trying to remember his quote, just, you know, be careful. He ain't what you think he is. He wasn't involved.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention, too, is as soon as you get a hold of him, it sounds like he's very quick to try and run down Larry.
Immediately. And, I mean, I'm looking at his service record. I see how involved he is. I've got the dates when he was posted on base. I mean, I know when he was assigned his weapon. I know a lot of stuff that Holt doesn't know, I know.
Yeah.
And I'm not really interested in telling him all that. I'm just interested in letting him know I'm working on this book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm open-minded. My first priority is the truth and not, you know, getting defensive at all. That wherever this takes me, it's going to take me. And, you know, we left off that call, and I should say that call and my other calls with him, I began by saying I would like your permission to tape record this call. I will, of course, send you a copy of this tape recording. I would like your permission to use part or full transcriptions from this and any other conversations that we have. And he was very forthcoming on that. Sure, no problem. So when I called him back a second time, which was only a week or two later, I had Larry there by my side.
Yeah.
And I caught him off guard and told him that. Said, would you like to speak to him? And he hadn't spoken to him. They hadn't spoken since they were in the service together.
Yeah.
And they were both rather cordial with each other, you know, as well as you can be on the defensive. And said, Mr. Holt, if we can get ourselves down to your part of the country, would you meet with us? Sure, I'd be glad to. And at that point, we began to plan a trip south. And the first part of it for me was going down to South Carolina and spending a week working on the manuscript thus far with our wonderful and very dedicated editor. And then I met Larry in Washington, and we stayed with several interesting folks. The first part of the trip, we stayed with an extraordinary guy, Gus Russo, who wrote a book called that came out four years ago, called Live by the Sword, 5 years ago. It's a remarkable book on what Gus felt was the dynamics behind the Kennedy assassination.
Okay.
And Gus was one of the preeminent Kennedy assassination researchers, great guy too. Spent some time with another researcher down there. We met with Chuck DeCaro, and ultimately, of course, I called Mr. Holt when we got down there, and he wasn't quite as cordial this time around. I did not let him know that we had only a limited amount of time down there, and had already bought our return tickets, played close to the vest, and can you meet with us this night? Nope. And starting to feel my heart drop there, and again, not trying to lose, you know, the straightness in my voice. And, well, how about, is there any time you can? And, well, Tuesday. We were leaving on Wednesday. And he was the one who set the time and place. And it was a great moment, especially for a nonfiction writer, where you're talking to this semi-legendary former military figure caught up in this huge drama.
Yeah.
And he says on the phone with real military bearing, you know where the Pentagon is? And I found myself saying, yes, sir. And I don't usually say sir. I've never been in the military. I'm fairly informal. He said, okay, right across the street from the Pentagon, there is a mall, shopping mall. It's called Pentagon City. Meet me in the food court at 1 o'clock, at 1:30, whenever. It's like, whoa. And we were there. and we had another guy with us to be a neutral observer. We went into the food court, and for the next hour and 20 minutes, we had one of the most impacting conversations and listened to what he had to say. And he had us turn off that recorder several times and told us things off the record. And he did something after the fact, and he said to Larry, he said to him on the phone, he said to him in person, "I can't say whether you were there or involved or not. We were in different parts of the forest. We would have been doing different things. But you have to understand, you know, you've got a reputation, and I've got to cover all the bases here, and I've got to be skeptical." And
yeah,
we absolutely understood. But shortly after he retired, and I discuss all of this at the end of the book, as you know,
yeah,
he was invited for the first time to speak at a UFO conference that was in England. And he did, and was well-received. And after the fact, like is the way it is at conferences, he was approached by several guys who chatted with him informally after. And at one point, one of them said, "What about Larry Warren?" And Halt said to him, "Wasn't involved, wasn't there, wannabe," something like that.
Yeah.
Not knowing that this guy was actually a friend of Larry's and mine, who called me immediately, and I went ballistic. I was furious, and my feeling was, all right, you know, you've just lied. You have said something to these guys that you have said to Larry and I that you cannot possibly know the truth on. You have also told us things off the record that confirm your interest in how serious he was involved in this. And now you're saying the opposite. So screw the insinuation that I was going to keep this stuff off the record. Off the record, I am now going to say it. And the fact of the matter is, had he wanted to, he could have instituted legal action or bad-mouthed me. To the best of my knowledge, he's never said anything bad about me, and he certainly never had his attorney contact mine. And among the things that he told us off the record, which are now very much on the record, which he has never denied, is that he was interested in Larry saying that the NSA had grabbed his records and that they were very interested in him. He confirmed that through contacts in the Pentagon, he found that that was absolutely the truth. And he told us face-to-face about these beams of light from these unknowns penetrating down into the Arden bunkers and adversely affecting the ordnance. And I decided, well, you want to play at this, then I will make this material public. And he has never, ever denied it, any of the things that I put on the record. I wish him well. I have a lot of respect for him, and I know Larry does too. But you can't do that. And to the best of my knowledge, he's been very careful about doing it since.
Yeah. So you haven't, like, talked to him since the book came out or anything like that?
I'm trying to think. Since the book came out, we sent him a copy, of course. I think I spoke to him once. But only in passing, if.
Yeah, so it wasn't like he wasn't outraged or
no,
like
no, not to, and I certainly, not certainly, there's a very good chance, had he been angry or upset or, felt in any way violated by this, that it would have come back to
yeah,
me through the grapevine,
yeah,
in no way has it, no. I wish him well.
Now, when you meet him, you're pretty cynical about witnesses coming forward. You kind of say something like, I wouldn't encourage anybody to come forward now.
Yeah.
Why bother? Why go put through the trouble and all that? Do you still agree with that sort of stance, or are you a little more encouraging to people to start it?
I'm very circumspect about it. If somebody has had an experience, especially in a military context, and they feel righteous indignation, they feel compelled to make what happened to them public, they owe it to themselves and to the people they love to educate themselves about what happens often to people that put themselves on this spot, like Larry and others have.
Yeah.
And if they are all right with that, and if they have some familial support, etc., God bless them, you know, absolutely trumpet it from the highest trees. If you are not sure, don't do it. Or, you know, you can always go forward, but
you can't
take
go
the
back.
Time. That's right. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So I would, by all means, caution anyone who feels that, you know, they're considering doing this, to give it a tremendous amount of thought and reflection and consult with people whose opinion you respect before doing it. And if you do it, do it right, and you know, put it on the record in every possible way that you can, and back it up in every way you can, and ideally wait until you know you have whatever you need at, or can get your hands on, to, if humanly possible, back up your allegations. So I think that's best left in the hands of the individual. You know, if it was a perfect world, I'd encourage everybody that's had an experience like this to come forward and put it on record and help, you know, create a public outcry for a release of the truth, which I'm more and more cynical that we are going to see through our governments. It's just not going to happen unless their hand is forced in some way that we can only imagine.
Yeah.
But I have only respect for people, especially military folks that have had experiences, that don't want to come forward and put it on the record. And in the updated version of Left at Eastgate, you'll see some, just that, some tremendous additions to the public record of individuals that had experiences that support Larry's, were aspects of it, or interestingly, other similar experiences when assigned to the same base before Larry was there, and in some cases some years after.
Huh.
So, you know, stuff continues. But that's a very good question, and depending on the individual, I'd answer it in those two different ways.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned destabilization. You call it now, like, silly fucking games.
Yeah.
And how they mess with some of the people who were doing the research and the whistleblowers and stuff. Did you experience much of that?
I didn't, but they did jerk me around a bit, they, in quotes, whoever they are.
Yeah.
I know for a fact, and it was another thing I forgot to add in those, when you had asked me about that period of time after we came back from the first trip to England. I had a friend who's very savvy technologically, and he ran some checks on my telephone line.
Yeah.
And I'm living in the middle of New York City, and said I was hearing these weird clicks and taps that I was just, I couldn't, you know, I never heard them before.
Yeah.
But I guess it's the way that I am. My first reaction was not, oh my God, the government's tapped my phone. My first reaction was, I live in the middle of New York City. It's New York telephone. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing you don't hear crap on the phone lines more often. But what he did was he did all these impedance registrations and things and did it several times and said in his own way that he felt that my phone was being irregularly monitored and that he had no idea who it was or why they were doing it. And my first reaction was, what are you talking about? Why would they let me know with all these obvious sounds on the phone? The whole idea is to surreptitiously get information and find out who I'm talking to and what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He said, no, that's only one of two reasons that your phone would be monitored. The other is to freak you out, to let you know they're monitoring it.
Yeah.
This is also when my mail occasionally would start to be opened and then, quote-unquote, officially resealed. The nice folks that you meet in the book, the wonderful Warnock family in Suffolk.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to mention the book.
Yeah.
You go over there to visit.
Yeah, I'll be seeing them. I'll be spending Christmas with them. And so will most of my family this time. I'm very pleased to say they're like family. I love them. But their mail was starting to get opened.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Wow.
And their phones were starting to be monitored.
Oh,
and that's a fact that they will confirm and know on certain terms to anybody that asks.
Huh.
And these are very down-to-earth people. They're wonderful people who had the courage to stick by us and say, we're part of the story now, too, and there's no way we're not going to back you up on this stuff. They're just sensational. But these things started to pile up on me, and they upset me very much. They also changed the way that I use the phone for quite a number of years. You know, when you think that there's somebody listening in, you're a lot more careful about what you say.
Yeah.
And there are certain people, and it's usually the people you care about the most, that you say the least, or you're starting to sound more disconnected, or, you know, like you don't really want to talk to them. And, I mean, this is way pre-cell phone era, and there was many times I'd head out onto the street with a pocket full of quarters and go to the nearest payphone and make my calls. No joke.
Yeah.
And actually, the kind of postscript on this sort of behavior was I came to understand through channels over the years that when I would go to England, when I would pass through customs control, passport control,
yeah,
you know, allegorically bells and whistles would go off somewhere, and my movements, my whereabouts would be monitored irregularly when I was in the United Kingdom.
Wow.
And where it all came home to me was on our book tour, when we were in Suffolk, and it was a real high point because we were speaking in Woodbridge, which is the village nearest to where this happened, the most substantial village near, one with a bookstore, and we were doing a book signing, and at the book signing, a woman named Brenda Butler showed up, and Brenda was one of the three original researchers on this case, a courageous, interesting gal who, you know, was the first to say that some of the information they put in their book had been manipulated or shaped by the forces that be. But they had their ear to the ground the day after this happened. I mean, there's a local gal.
Yeah.
And she came up to me and she said, I have a bone to pick with you. And she did not look happy at all.
Yeah.
And we took her out to lunch with the book dealer. And over lunch, she turned to me and she said, you know, I wasn't kidding. I really have something I've got to talk to you about that really made me angry. And then proceeded to say, you remember when you first wrote to me, and I had written to her early on in 87,
yeah,
and suggested that, you know, we start to exchange information. I was now working with Larry, who she certainly knew well and spent time with, and she was open to that and let her know that we were going to be coming to the UK and all this. And I wrote her again when I got back, but I never heard back from her, and again, I was very preoccupied, and people's lives go on. I was going to harp on it, and I never heard from her again, and she never heard from me again. Anyway, it's now like 9 years later,
yeah,
and we're sitting over lunch, and she said, do you remember when you came to England for the first time to do research in February 88? Yes, of course. Okay. You know, you had been here a day or two, whatever, and you contacted me and introduced yourself on the phone and said, you know, I would, you know, we really should meet and talk, and I agreed. I thought that was a very good idea, and you set the time and place, and it was that pub about a mile and a half from where you were staying, the Cherry Tree, and I agreed to meet you there, and I showed up, and not only did you not show up, you never had the courtesy to call me, and frankly, oh, no, wait, hold it a second, let me just...
Right, okay,
to call me, and I was pissed off, and when you wrote to me, I didn't respond, and that's why. And Tim, I'm listening to her say this, and I am getting very anxious, and I look at her, and I say, Brenda, I'm paraphrasing here, but this is the gist of it. I hear you, I appreciate, I'm convinced you're telling me the truth as you know it. If you get to know me better, as I hope you will, you'll find out I am not the kind of person who would leave you hanging like that. Even if it was just a social situation, that's not the way I was brought up. I would have called and canceled that appointment or rescheduled. Brenda, I never called you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I saw her get visibly pale, and she said, oh, my God, I believe you. And we looked at each other, and we realized that for the cost of a 10p call, someone in the know with an American accent making believe they were me, Tim, called her in February 88, set up this appointment, and for like almost no effort and no money, drove a wedge between two fairly significant researchers who could have really assisted each other in putting this thing together over 9 years, and instead created this fabulous fake misunderstanding.
Yep.
But I was shaken.
Yeah.
Somebody made believe they were me, and I mean, this was calculated. This was really something.
Yeah.
So that sort of brought the whole point home to me, but frankly, I have always been on record as saying that everything I knew went into that book, and you know, 99 and 99.44%. That is true. I wasn't holding back something when we went to press, you know, to drop one more bomb, because I felt that would be dangerous. I did not want to get hurt. I did not want to be jerked around anymore.
Yeah.
I did not want to jeopardize my health or safety or peace of mind any more than it had been. And I had one very simple rule the whole time I was working, from the time I really got back into it, which was, this is my life, and I'm free to do with it what I want. I am single. You know, I love my sisters and my parents and my family and my friends, but I'm going to push this thing as much as I can to realistic limits. However, if anybody approaches me and identifies themselves in absolutely credible ways that I can accept that they are, you know, part of that contingent of folks, and they even suggest that if I don't get off this, that somebody I do care about will get hurt or worse, I'm out of it.
Yeah.
I will not be happy, but that is the secret. And I didn't tell anybody that, because, you know, when you tell one person, you tell everybody in a way.
Yeah.
So that was the operating principle for me. And once the book was even in galleys, I had a tremendous peace of mind surge that I had not had in almost a decade. I knew that at least we were going to go into print, and that I had no interest in, you know, playing fake spy or something. And, you know, I've got a few more fabulous bits of, you know, nuclear information to drop on your heads, folks.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of peace of mind since, and, you know, moved more back into being who I was before I met Larry, and, you know, continue with what I've learned from these episodes and this extraordinary project, and am more for it. But I wasn't going to fuck around with these folks on this.
Oh, yeah.
It was going to, you know, you play it straight. And I, you know, played by my own rules, and I never broke them.
Now, that kind of goes to this next question I have, was the NSA. You seem pretty terrified about even researching them or writing them, and that they were even involved in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I guess at that time, they weren't as well known as they are now.
That's correct.
So what, were you spooked when you first started looking into this NSA thing? Because it sounds like you didn't even want to touch that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't. And I wished that trail had led someplace else. I'm a student of American history, and I was fairly as well studied about the NSA as most civilians can be, with the exception of Bamford's The Puzzle Palace, which is still one of the few absolutely outstanding books on the subject. It's extraordinary, and Mr. Bamford has written a follow-up book since. I read everything I could on the NSA even before this, and once I had even a hint that Larry had been caught up in their net and that they were the ones who had confiscated his records, and that his records were at Fort Detrick, Maryland, at their headquarters, and that we would need lawyers and high-powered ones to even have a shot at going down there to meet with them, which I was not thrilled to do, that they were the great, you know, vacuumers up of phone calls and satellite communications,
yeah,
that they had checked me out on some level, that I was now known to them as a potential problem. The NSA, from the start, has always had more power, more chops, has been better funded than the CIA. When they were created in November 52, when they went into effect, it was done so surreptitiously that they were put into effect at midnight, election night, when Eisenhower was elected. So the hope was, if any rumor got out in even the bureaucracy, the regular military or government bureaucracy, it would be covered up by, you know, all the news of the new administration. And I was frightened. I was frightened that this was playing with the big boys. Even when I worked on the manuscript at the end, when I discussed my feelings about the NSA, that was kept on a separate floppy disk, And when I delivered the manuscript on disk, that was delivered separately. And it was not integrated into the text till the very last minute, because I didn't even want my publisher to know until the last minute that these were the guys that I intended to come down on the hardest at the end.
Yeah.
My feeling was, if I did it that way, my hope was they would probably say, okay, this is potentially embarrassing, but who's kidding who? How many people are going to read this book? 5,000, 10,000, who knows? We had no idea at the time it was going to be a bestseller in the UK. And even if they do, who's going to believe it? And even if they believe it, what are they going to do about it? Nobody knows we're even here anyway. But they are the force to be reckoned with. And I thought to myself, if I make it as clear as I can, directly, indirectly, overtly, covertly, that I have just basically played my hand here. I have nothing else on them. Most of it is speculative anyway. I can't prove anything beyond what I've established in the book. I am a bug going up against a tank. It's like trying to fight a howitzer with a spider web. I mean, yeah. I had all these wonderful analogies, and the best I could do was think to myself that if I do it this way, at least they'll know that, you know, I'm not going to be coming back at them. I've done whatever damage I can. Maybe I'll get a little begrudging respect, which I think I have gotten. I can't tell you why, but I think I have. And, you know, in the ultimate irony for me was, and I think I was accurate in this, it was a calculated risk, but I think I was accurate, that once I was on the public record with the whole story and what I felt was their involvement in it, that at that point, were anything to happen to me, were I to be hit by a bus or choke on a chicken bone or fall down a flight of stairs, it didn't matter if it was completely legitimate. There would be many people out there that would say, oh, you know, NSA killed him.
Yeah.
And the best thing they could do was ignore my ass after that.
Yeah.
And that's what they've done. And I'm at peace of mind with that. But I absolutely maintain, still feel the same, and reiterate it in the revised version of the book, that they are deeply involved in monitoring this phenomena, in helping to maintain the secret, and that there are or is a working group or office within the NSA. It's not the NSA per se, that is deeply involved in the truth about UFOs, whatever that may happen to be, and I will. Nobody can convince me otherwise.